Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Your home for truth in broadcasting.
Now, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, an awful lot going on here. It's in particular with regard to the politics of it all. And greetings and welcome to the show. Particularly with regard to the politics of oil, Newt Gingrich is orchestrating this huge campaign behind the scenes. He's discovered that the majority of Americans think if we drill more, that that'll lower the price of oil. They're ignoring the fact that the majority of oil leases that have been given to the oil companies in the United States and federal lands are being sat on rather than used. I'm not talking about offshore oil. So we'll get into that a little bit later on as the program goes on. Don Siegelman's going to drop by in our third hour, the former governor of the state of Alabama, political prisoner of Karl Rove. And we'll get an update on what's going on with him. Mike Gravel is going to drop by. Rick Perlstein in our second hour talking about how, in his new book, Nixon Land, that Nixon was the grandfather of today's politics of hate. Anthony Romero from the ACLU is going to drop by at the end of this hour just to give us an update on what's going on with the ACLU. Right now, Stephen Halbrook is with us. He's a fellow at the Independent Institute. He received his J.D., his Doctor of Law from Georgetown University Law Center, and PhD from Florida State. He's won three cases before the Supreme Court, written several books on the right to bear arms. His website, independent.org. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Glad to be on the show, Tom.
The Supreme Court just this landmark ruling on Guantanamo. It's one of what are expected to be two really blockbuster cases that the court is going to be ruling on, the other being this Second Amendment case about whether or not Washington, D.C.'s virtually total ban on handguns is constitutional. Is that a statement that you'd agree with?
Yes, it is. The Supreme Court hasn't looked at the Second Amendment since a 1939 case, and before that, virtually never. So this is breaking new ground. This will be the first time, presumably, that the court will definitively address the meaning of the right of the people to keep and bear arms.
Right. That 39 case, wasn't that like the Miller case or something?
Yes, it was. And it was a very narrow decision that both sides of the controversy cite on their way. So.
Right. And that was the case that essentially said that the government can regulate weapons and use that right, or that power, rather, to regulate things like sawed-off shotguns and machine guns.
Right. The court held that the test for whether a weapon was constitutionally protected was whether it was militia-type weapon or ordinary military ordnance. But I think the court now is going to back away from that theory. The court seemed that oral argument to be moving toward if it's an individual right, that it would have a self-defense component. But I think that they're going to back away from a military-type weapon analysis.
Now, if the framers of the Constitution and the authors of the Bill of Rights actually intended for there to be a right to own a weapon for self-defense, why didn't they write that into the Second Amendment? Why does it say in order to maintain a well-regulated militia?
Well, first of all, the text states that refers to the right of the people to keep and bear arms. They did not put in...
Following the militia statement.
Right. Let me
as part of one single sentence.
Right. They gave a reason for that right being federally recognized. They did not say duck hunting being lots of fun, the people have a right, et cetera. They wanted to encourage a well-regulated militia, and they felt that by having that right recognized on the part of the people at large, it would facilitate the creation and maintenance of a well-regulated militia. If people couldn't own guns and didn't know how to shoot straight, you could not have a militia, because that's what a militia meant, a society where a military component consisted of ordinary people at large who were part-time soldiers and not a standing army.
You know, we're talking with Stephen Halbrook. He's also the author of The Founder's Second Amendment, Origins of the Right to Bear Arms. And, Stephen, I have your book here, and I've spent a fair amount of time with it. And I would suggest to you that while you give, you tip your hat, as it were, you know, you give passing reference to the concern of many of the founders, arguably most of the founders, that we should not have a standing army. I mean, this is one of the big debates. And, in fact, Jefferson points out that at one point a total ban on standing armies in the United States ever during times of peace was defeated by only one vote in the House of Representatives. You quote, for example, Eldridge Gerry, who was one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence and, you know, a true patriot. And you say in your book, Eldridge Gerry clarified that the purpose of the amendment was protection from oppressive government. And then you quote him, and he wasn't saying that. He says, "This Declaration of Rights, I take it, is intended to secure the people against the maladministration of the government." He says, "What, sir, is the use of a militia? It is to prevent the establishment of a standing army, the bane of liberty." In other words, the maladministration of government that Gerry was talking about, that Jefferson was talking about, I can give you 20 different quotes from Jefferson on this, and I'm sure you know them as well as I do, was that these guys all felt that if we had a standing army in the United States during times of peace, it could do what Musharraf did in Pakistan, and that is overthrow or become at least such a large and powerful instrument that it distorts, badly distorts, the civilian government, which, frankly, I would submit to you we are seeing right now with a $500 billion Pentagon budget.
Well, of course, an oppressive government would be equivalent to one maintained by a standing army, and there were those who proposed in the first federal Congress that it would require two-thirds vote of Congress to even have a standing army.
Right. Yeah, this was the big issue.
Far afield from where we were at that point, you had most of the framers of the Constitution being opposed to standing armies. You had the capacity created for one, but they wanted to rely on a militia more than a standing army.
Because it was locally controlled.
With Britain. I agree totally with that. And
so why is it that people who are Second Amendment, hardcore Second Amendment supporters, let's say, I'm not going to use inflammatory rhetoric like fanatics or something like that, but why is it that the folks who believe that the Second Amendment is all about guns don't talk about that? I mean, this was the genesis of the Second Amendment. The first, second, third, fourth drafts of this originally, I mean, it originally arguably started with Jefferson's letter to Madison when Madison sent him the Constitution, and Jefferson was in Paris, and he sent back a letter saying, you know, this is all well and good, but it doesn't, you know, in fact, here, let me give you the exact quote. He said, this is his letter to Madison. He says, "With respect to the new government, 9 or 10 states will probably have accepted it by the end of this month. The others may oppose it. Virginia, I think, will be of this number." In other words, he's going to lobby his own state to screw up the Constitution. Why? He says, "Because other objections of less moment, she will," this is Virginia, "will insist on annexing a Bill of Rights to the new Constitution, wherein the government shall declare that, 1, religion shall be free, 2, printing presses shall be free, 3, trials by jury preserved in all cases," which is what the Supreme Court just ruled on last week, by the way, 4, no monopolies in commerce." What? "Number 5, no standing army. Upon receiving this Bill of Rights, she," Virginia, "will probably depart from her other objections." That, you know, why are you guys not out there saying we need to disband the standing armies and go back to militias? Because that's really what the Second Amendment's all about. It's not about whether, you know, some drug lord in Washington, D.C. should have the right to carry a MAC-10.
Right. Well stated. And this country's gone very far afield from that original conception that we would have either no or minimal standing army. But that doesn't preclude the fact that the amendment refers to the right of the people to keep and bear arms. The two clauses are not inconsistent. By having an armed populace recognizing the right of the people to keep and bear arms, that promotes the possibility of having a well-regulated militia. But as the anti-federalists pointed out, the militia clause of the Second Amendment was somewhat of an empty phrase-mongering because there was already... the militia power was recognized in the text of the Constitution already, the division between the state and federal governments as regards organization and arming of the militia. But the anti-federalist people like Patrick Henry wanted a lot more than just a declaration that a militia was necessary for the security of a free state. They wanted a prohibition on standing armies, and they didn't get it.
Right, and maybe we should have one now. Standing, and let's qualify that, standing armies during time of peace. What they wanted was every single able-bodied male between the ages of 17 and 46, was Jefferson's original proposal, to be essentially drafted, to have to learn the you know, what it means to be, to how to operate a weapon and military whatever decorum, and then if we were invaded or there was a time of necessity, military necessity, the church bells would ring all across the country and people would grab their gun out of their closet and step outside their house and boom, you'd have the militia. But the local militia, it's basically what we have right now with the National Guard. I mean, that's the remnant of our militia.
Except that that's what's left of it, but the National Guard, when in federal service, is really part of the standing army. They can be sent overseas and treated just like an army. But
I know it's a malformation of what the founders intended.
Right, exactly. And the way you described it is exactly what the colonists did at Lexington and Concord. They had their own arms that they testified they hunted. They were good shots.
Stephen, can you stick around? I want to continue this conversation with you for just a minute here, if it's all right. Great. We're talking with Stephen Halbrook, his website, independent.org, an advocate of Second Amendment gun rights, as I guess they would be described. And we have this big Supreme Court decision coming up. Stick around. 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
We need a gunslinger, somebody come to tame this town. Think we need a gunslinger, there'll be justice all around. I think we need a gunslinger, somebody come to tame this town.
Oh, is that what we need?
Think we need
every one of us to become gunslingers? We're talking with Stephen Halbrook, his website, independent.org. A fellow at the Independent Institute, an attorney. He's won 3 cases before the Supreme Court, written several books on the right to bear arms. And, Stephen, let me just, for our listeners, just lay out my perspective on this, and then you can lay out yours and we can discuss it.
Okay.
I think that at the federal level, it's entirely appropriate that there be limits on weapons that can be used essentially as weapons of mass destruction. That is, things that can kill more than one person at a time. Machine guns, surface-to-air missiles, mortars, the weapons of war, basically. I think that that's an entirely appropriate thing. Yet those are arms. And the founders, but you know, as you point out in one of your essays, the founders, when they talked about, if you go back to Webster's Dictionary, arms meant things that you could stash under your jacket, presumably. But I don't think that they meant that, because they meant rifles. But in any case, I think that it's entirely appropriate the federal government to do that. And B, I think that with regard to handguns, that the regulation of that should be left to the states and the cities. It should not be limited by the federal government. So New York City and Washington, D.C. should have the right to say we want to be a handgun-free zone. But on the other hand, in Vermont, where I lived for 10 years, it is legal without a permit to carry a concealed weapon.
Right.
And that should be Vermont's choice. That's my take on this issue. Your take.
American citizens have freedoms guaranteed in the Bill of Rights, and these rights apply not only to the federal government but to states and localities, so that it would not be allowed that New York City could have unreasonable searches and seizures, but you don't have them in Vermont. And by the same token, if the people have a right to keep and bear arms, that right should not be infringed by localities any more than it should be infringed by the federal government. Now, the case in the Supreme Court...
But if I may interrupt you, just the case, the right of against unreasonable search and seizure is explicit and unqualified. The right to bear arms is qualified by the statement that in order to maintain a well-regulated militia. It's a contextual assertion of rights rather than an absolute assertion of rights, unlike the Fourth Amendment.
The Fourth Amendment refers to unreasonable searches and seizures, not
right.
Search and seizures. And the Second Amendment refers to the right of the people not being infringed. And it does not specify that they can only keep arms if the government conscripts them in a militia to keep arms.
But even at the right. time of the founding of our country, the ownership
that.
Of large military weapons was controlled.
That they did conscript people into militia, but by the same token, the Constitution refers to the right of the people to assemble to keep and bear arms, and so we're talking about something you don't need to be conscripted by government to do.
But again, the right of assembly is not a qualified right. The right to bear arms is a qualified
right.
Well,
all the rights are qualified to some extent. You can't
assemble
on somebody else's property. You couldn't assemble inside the Supreme Court and have a demonstration there.
Well, they're qualified at law, but they're not qualified in the amendments themselves. That's what I'm talking about.
Well, the language of the amendment.
The
First Amendment, we talk about rights not being impaired, and the Second Amendment, rights not being infringed. These are synonyms for, like, they can only go so far and no further. And so nobody's questioning, by the way, federal regulations on heavy weapons and whatnot. What's at stake?
Well, why not? I mean, if a ban
on possession of the type of firearm that's mostly used by law-abiding people for self-defense, handguns.
Right. So why is it that the police department of Washington, D.C. wants this ban kept in place and you want it overturned?
Well,
why are you not siding with the police?
Different police chiefs at different times have made diverse statements. There was a former police chief who basically admitted that the law had done no good and he didn't know why law-abiding citizens couldn't exercise the same rights as people in every other state in the country.
Mm-hmm.
D.C. has been the murder capital of the country for many years since this law was passed, and you go across the river to Maryland or Virginia, and you have low crime rates, and you still have the ability of citizens to possess handguns. And
people can buy them and then carry them into Washington, D.C. I mean, I think you could make an argument that D.C. is suffering more from a poverty problem than a gun problem.
I totally agree. What's lost sight of in this debate are all the different causes of crime, lack of education and economic
lack of good jobs.
Jobs and just a culture of criminality, the drug problems and all that.
Right.
It's oversimplification.
Stephen, we have just a minute left. I'm sorry to be moving this along, but
okay.
I'd like to get, if the Supreme Court rules that the Washington, D.C. law is constitutional and they uphold it, this is going to give a huge baseball bat to the Republicans to turn gun rights into an issue for this election. Do you agree?
I agree with that. I think that most Americans think they have a right to keep and bear arms, and if the Supreme Court tells them they don't, they're going to be upset. And so when they see that they have rights protected by the Bill of Rights, these rights should be interpreted.
On the other hand, in a lot of big cities, a lot of Americans are very supportive of the restriction of weapons in their cities.
Well, there's a lot of restrictions that aren't at issue here, things like licensing and background checks and all of that. Nobody's questioning those kinds of regulations. All that's being questioned is a total ban on possession of an ordinary firearm by law-abiding people.
Yeah, well, it's going to be a very interesting decision, and the response to it is going to be fascinating. Stephen Halbrook, independent.org is website, the author of numerous books, including The Founder's Second Amendment, Origins of the Right of the Right to Bear Arms. Stephen, thanks for dropping by.
Thank you, Tom. Glad to be on the show.
Good conversation. 27 minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270, our telephone number, tomhartman.com for our live chat room, airamerica.com. You can check out our video streaming.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
To town. He drank his first strong liquor then to calm his shaking hand and tried to tell himself at last he had become a man. A dusty cowpoke at his side began to laugh him down and he heard again his mother's words. Don't take your guns to town, son. Leave your guns at home, Bill. Don't take your guns to town.
Yeah, this has become a real solid part of American folklore, history, everything else. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. By the way, we're going to run our contest today. We're going to be giving away a copy of Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. And, in fact, this particular copy I will be autographing for the person who wins the contest. The contest will be whoever posts what is in Sean Taylor, our producer's opinion, her esteemed opinion, her favorite, we'll just call it her favorite post over at TomHartmann.com on our blog for today's show. So, you know, whatever you come up with. 866-303-2270. Before I get to your phone calls, I just want to lay out, I think that in addition to, frankly, you know, states and municipalities dealing with this, because there are rural parts of this country where the concern about gun control and guns are completely different from very urban parts of this country. And I'm a supporter of, as much as I understand the Second Amendment, I also understand the Ninth and Tenth Amendments, which, you know, in particular the Tenth Amendment, which says basically that the government is going to stay out of the business of the states. So if a state wants to regulate handguns in their own state or even ban them or a city, I think that they should have that right. Here you have two parts of the Bill of Rights seemingly at conflict, at odds with each other. And I also think that we should have a national militia, not a national militia. I think that we should have local militias. We should go back to that founding vision like they do in Switzerland, where we say, if you know, every basically a draft. And I think that it should be an exchange, and it should be an exchange for free education. We should offer free education, whether it's vocational education or whether it's college education, to anybody who wants it. In exchange for that, they have to serve 1 year in some sort of a military service, or if they have a religious or philosophical, even a political objection to that, they can work in hospitals, they can work in nonprofits, in childcare facilities, elder care facilities, you know, an ecology facility, cleaning up the highways, planting trees, whatever. They have some option, but a year of service to your country. And then let's reduce the power of the federal government, as it were, of this national entity, and to take it to the level of local militias. Jefferson, he was writing, he says, our men are so happy to stay at home, they will not hire themselves to be shot at for a shilling a day. He didn't ever want to see the day when you had a national military that was basically paying people to die. He said, it is more a subject of joy that we have so few desperate characters which compose modern regular armies, but it proves forcibly the necessity of obliging every citizen to be a soldier. This is a necessity for a free state where there is no oppression. There will be no pauper hirelings. We got nothing but pauper hirelings here these days. Mark in Laramie, New Mexico, listening on KTRC. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hey, Tom. When you mentioned Switzerland, I was struck when you read the early American version of what a regulated militia is. When I lived in Switzerland, every man between the ages of 18 and 50, I think it was required to have an assault rifle, one of the finest select-fire assault rifles that we have in the world, and ammo, and get together a few weeks out of the year with his local neighbors, actually,
right,
to practice defending their land.
Right, and these are organized at the city and at the canton level, at the state level,
yeah.
And it's, many argue it's one of the reasons, aside from the mountains, that Hitler never invaded Switzerland.
They stayed out of World War One and Two. There were other reasons like gold and banking and stuff,
sure,
like that, but to this day, it would be suicide. Even with nuclear weapons, they have bomb shelters dug into their mountainsides that can take in the entire population of the Swiss within 12 hours.
Yeah, the Swiss have been survivors for a long, long time, and they're following the founder's vision of this country with regard to the military. I think it was a brilliant one. Mark, thank you for the call, and thank you for the amen there. Alan in Seattle. Hey, listening on Talk 1090. Hey, Alan.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Well, I think we're talking about two different things here, and one is licensing and one is banning.
Right.
And as a veteran and a lifelong Democrat, I'm a very pro-Second Amendment. And most of my friends up here that are liberals who disagree with the right to carry arms or believe it should only go to the military, I simply point to George Bush and say there's a reason why I don't think any of us should give up all of our weapons.
So, okay, let's pull on that thread a little bit, Alan, because I hear that from a lot of folks, and I consider myself very pro-Second Amendment, too, so apparently we're interpreting it differently, because I think that the Second Amendment basically is an anti-standing army during times of peace amendment and requires something like Switzerland has, frankly. But setting that aside for the moment, the point you just made, make it again.
Yes. Well, I agree that they talk about well-regulated militias. And I'm not an absolute expert on constitutional law. I've taken a little bit of classes on it. But I also know the Second Amendment, the way it is written, the way our professor discussed it to us, it is written in the same way that all other rights in the Constitution are written about, in the form of individual rights as opposed to group rights, the wording that is used.
But see, so the Constitution doesn't grant rights.
Huh?
The Constitution doesn't grant rights. The Constitution limits the power of government.
Correct. So when the Constitution talks about limiting the power of government over a group or over an individual, the wording that is used in the Second Amendment is the same language that is used in the free speech and other
No, but the point you made a moment ago was that George Bush was the reason why you think that people should be able to have guns. And I know that you're not calling for his assassination or anything like that. What you're talking about is that if a government becomes oppressive, as Thomas Jefferson wrote in the Declaration of Independence, it is not just the right, it is the duty of the people to overthrow that government and provide for new services. Is that the point that you're making?
That is the point, but also in the right to carry and bear arms, there have been Supreme Court decisions which have said the police actually have no responsibility, and in case there's very famous cases on it, they have no responsibility to actually show up at a crime scene.
I understand all that. Now you're talking about self-defense, but I want to get back to this issue because this is the one, like when I go on these right-wing radio shows, and I'm talking about the really, you know, like the shortwave ones out of Colorado, and they're literally talking to communities of people who are hoarding guns and food, and they are all about being able to overthrow an oppressive government. And my response to them is, do you really think that you know, having a Walther PK-35 or having a SIG or even having, you know, 400 AK-47s or even, for that matter, having a couple of surface-to-air missiles is going to stop the U.S. military? I mean, you know, it's a joke.
One person will not. But my father was a member of the Green Berets, and he also served in World War II. And he talked about how it was very important that we even get plans on how to make guns to the French resistance, how they could make them from bicycle parts, how they could do these things. One individual with a gun is not going to do anything. 10,000 individuals, of which 100 of them have guns.
Right. But the French resistance were not successful. It took our army to take out Hitler's army, ours and Russia's. It took an army to take out an army. And you know, if you guys want to be able to overthrow the government of the United States, which is not something that I would advocate, I think that we should be looking at overthrowing it by political means, you know, straightforward. But nonetheless, those gun advocates, those so-called Second Amendment advocates, purists who say that we must have our guns in case the government gets oppressive, I say, you know, how are you going to handle black helicopters and you know, helicopter gunships and bombers there's no force in the world, including the citizenry of the United States, no matter how well armed they are, who could stand up to the power of the United States government. So then why defend the Second Amendment on that basis?
Okay, the reason here is an insurgency like we're fighting right now in Iraq, okay, can paralyze an army. And we find constantly, as is happening right now in Iraq, political developments then become such that members of the current military or stronger political...
But you've got a couple hundred thousand dead people in Iraq. You've got 4 million refugees. I mean, is that something... Are you wishing another civil war in the United States? That was the bloodiest war we ever fought.
Okay, I will tell you, no, I don't want a civil war in the U.S., but I will say, and I'm not agreeing with a lot of things that are happening right now in Iraq. I certainly do not support the war there, but I know that many of those people that are dead were not fighting for Al-Qaeda. They're fighting for what they believe to be their freedom.
Oh, absolutely. The vast majority of them, according to the Pentagon, the vast majority of them simply want U.S. occupiers out. They feel that they have an occupied country.
That's the situation that we're talking about. And I think that's the situation many people are talking about on the right to bear arms, where, in all honesty, if the Bush regime were to get worse, the price of a couple hundred thousand dead to try to drive them out of power until we could get enough of the military to come onto the side of people that would want to restore the Constitution is not too high a price to pay, and I do not think Thomas Jefferson would think so.
Well, I don't know what Jefferson would say. You know, he at one point he said the tree of liberty needs to be watered by the blood of patriots. That was during the French Revolution. After the French Revolution, when he saw the terrors and he saw, you know, what old Maximilian was up to, and Robespierre and the guillotine and everything, at that point he essentially apologized for having said that. I think that if we were to look at, and Aylin, thanks a lot for the call, I think if something like that were to happen in this country, we would be opening a Pandora's box that would be unbelievably bad. It would be a tragedy beyond imagination. It's not a road we want to go down, and I don't think it's a strong or even a useful defense for the right to bear arms. 45 minutes past the hour. We're going to briefly hear from the ACLU and then back to your calls.
The Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
There's just strange stuff going on out there in the world. Drinking up to six cups of coffee. Up to six cups of coffee. Louise is right. She's a coffee junkie, has been her whole life. I was, you know, I like coffee, but, you know, six cups a day. Drinking up to six cups of coffee a day may lower the overall odds of dying prematurely. Women who drank 2 to 3 cups of coffee, for example, had a 25% lower risk of dying from heart disease than non-drinkers. It has beneficial effects on inflammation and endothelial function, which are the first stages of cardiovascular disease development, Lopez Garcia says, one of the lead authors of the Harvard School of Public Health report. Oh, interesting. Anthony Romero is with us. He is the executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU.org, and I am a proud and card-carrying member of the ACLU, and I encourage you to become one, too, ACLU.org. And, Anthony, you guys are into your largest civil rights and liberties fundraising campaign in history?
That's right, and we're 88 years old. But, wow. But it's much more than a fundraising campaign. This is more than about money. This is about building the civil liberties and civil rights infrastructure in the red states. We're not looking to buy buildings. We're not building an endowment. What we're looking is to take our offices that have often been there for decades, like our Texas office has been there for 70 years.
Right.
And it's always been too puny. It's always been too small. It's always been the David to the government's Goliath. And to grow it to a 45-person office.
That's great.
Mississippi, Florida, Tennessee, Missouri, New Mexico, Arizona, Michigan. Why are we picking these states? Because these are often the battleground states for civil liberties, where gay rights is on the line, where choice is on the line, where the death penalty is still being enacted. Where
freedom of speech.
Freedom of speech, freedom of religion. All those issues play out much more directly in the center of the country than on the coast.
Right.
And that's why we're building this infrastructure now. It's so important.
Well, that's absolutely marvelous. I wanted to get you on briefly to just plug that and say that I totally support it. I know our listeners do, and now is a really important time for people to go over to ACLU.org and show their support for the ACLU, join the ACLU, become, as George Herbert Walker Bush derisively said, a card-carrying member of the ACLU.
One of our finest moments when he derided us.
Indeed.
That.
Anthony, thanks so much for dropping by, and good luck.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Keep up the great work. It's great talking with you. ACLU.org. Check it out. Let's see here. Jay in the Bay Area in California. Hey, Jay, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I think you're a brilliant and honorable man. I just want to say that this Constitution regarding bearing arms, I think that's the most important thing we have right now. I believe Bush and his people are going to take over the country. I just have no doubt that they
are going to.
They were involved in that 9/11. I have no doubt the Pearl Harbor effect. And if they stole the last two elections, what leads one to think that what they won't do? They federalized the National Guard. They weaned the military, Justice Department, and the Supreme Court, and put in their own people. They've implemented a private military, Blackwater. They created doziers on 8 million Americans. They built detention camps in our country instead of continuing to build them. And most of our military is out of the country. And they monopolize control of our telecommunications and all our resources. And the only way that, and I believe the founding fathers.
So Jay, you think that we need to have an armed uprising against the Bush Reich?
No, because it will not work just like you said. I mean, we can't take on the military.
So what do we do?
In any situation, the military has to go along with the people.
Yeah.
If we don't have the military on our side, it will never happen.
Yeah. Excellent.
Excuse me?
No, I was going to say, okay, finish your thought there. I'm sorry.
Well, no, I'm just saying this is one of the reasons I think they're moving most of our military out the country.
Yeah.
And they're weaning our top officials in the military. Because they want people in there that will do what they say.
Yeah, it's one of the reasons why if you're, and thank you, Jay, for the call. It's one of the reasons why if you're a senior officer in the military, you have, you know, $1 million job waiting for you when you leave. If you're sufficiently compliant in private industry, it's one of the reasons why you have all these private contractors. You know, about half the military in Iraq right now is private contract. I mean, I'll go along with that. Jeff in Denver, Colorado, KKZN. Hey, Jeff.
Hi, I've urged that we take a pragmatic look at real-world examples. The countries with the most armed citizenry, such as Iraq and Afghanistan, have the most oppressive governments. Iraq had a dictator, but the citizens were armed.
Yeah.
While the least armed societies, such as Japan and European nations, have very free and stable societies.
That should tell us something, you're saying.
Yeah.
You know, the reverse argument of that is that the first thing that Hitler did in the Warsaw Ghetto was collect the guns.
Okay, but look at but guns are false power. Truth power comes from honest news media, good education, and accurate vote count.
Excellent
Bush
point.
Did not get in through violence. He got in through a stolen election, and you see that over and over again. And I would urge all gun advocates to put, you know, the people who really are into guns, turn that energy into accurate elections, and you will not have an oppressive government.
Well said, Jeff. Thank you very much. Brilliant observation as always. And to the absolute total folks who think that the Second Amendment is the be all and end all of everything, I say, there you go. John in Marin County. Hey, John. I'm sorry, John. I'd already moved along. I'm sorry, David in Detroit, Michigan, and WDTW. David, we got about a half a minute here before we got to wrap up this first hour of the show.
Okay, real quick, good. I just wanted to say, anybody who thinks that the right to bear arms would put down a government, an oppressive government, you got to remember the government has nuclear weapons. They would destroy you if they so chose. And the second point I wanted to make is, I think this whole debate underscores the difference between Democrats and Republicans. Democrats seem to take a more intellectual approach to issues, and we really think about things instead of just getting emotional. And like you said, yeah, the right to bear arms, it sounds, you know, glamorous. We're going to, you know, hold off this oppressive government, but be realistic. That the right to bear arms would never prevent the United States government from oppressing you if they so chose. You need to have accurate elections.
Yeah, accurate elections. You need to have an informed populace. You need to have a strong national media. You need to have voices that speak back. Like here on this show, we need more of this kind of media all around the United States. 57 minutes past the hour. Coming up after the news, Rick Perlstein, a senior fellow at the Campaign for America's Future, about Nixon land.
The Tom Hartman Program.
News without conflicts of global corporate interests. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Now, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Families USA, the voice for healthcare consumers, has the results of a new study out now. 50-state survey released today reveals that insurance companies in most states are not prohibited from denying health coverage to people with pre-existing conditions. They are not prohibited from refusing to pay for services needed to treat common ailments. And all of this is adding huge premium surcharges for people. Oh, they are not prohibited from adding huge premium surcharges for people with family histories of health problems. And they are not prohibited from yanking policies and denying payments when consumers face a rash of medical bills. In other words, just when you get sick, your insurance company can say, you know, we're not going to take your check anymore, and we're not going to pay anything anymore. Sorry, see you later. In fact, only 5 states prohibit insurance companies from cherry-picking the healthiest consumers and excluding everyone else. Only 35 states and districts in Columbia, there are no limits on how much an insurer can raise your premium based on your health status. Boom, you get cancer suddenly in 35 states in the United States. You get cancer, all of a sudden you're paying $5, $10, $15, $20,000 a month for health insurance. In 21 states in the District of Columbia, insurers can exclude coverage for pre-existing conditions for more than a year. In 44 states in the District of Columbia, insurers can revoke an individual's health insurance policy without advance review by the state. In other words, they can simply say, oh, you got sick? Yeah, we're not going to insure you anymore. That's 44 states. 29 states in the District of Columbia, insurers are allowed to deny legitimate claims of policyholders who are up to date with their premium payments by digging back years into their medical history and alleging that they failed to disclose or should have known about a pre-existing condition. Well, you have cancer, and you never noticed that you were feeling a little tired? We think that's a pre-existing condition. 45 states of the District of Columbia, insurers do not have to spend at least 75% of premium revenue on health care. In other words, they can take even more than 25% of all the money that they get in and spend it on things like executive compensation, so people like Bill McGuire can make more than $1.7 billion. And in 20 states and the District of Columbia, insurers can set and raise premiums anytime they want for any reason they want because there's no meaningful oversight. Carrie Lucas is with us. She's the Vice President of Policy and Economics at the Independent Women's Forum. Carrie, our question, will deregulating the healthcare industry turn into the Wild Wild West? Sounds to me like it's already pretty well deregulated.
I think you're listing a whole lot of regulations that don't exist. And what the study that you're talking about, it doesn't talk about how much these things are going on. So when they talk about the ability of people to, or ability of an insurance company to go ahead and drop someone from coverage the second they get cancer, they don't talk about exactly how much this is happening. So this is really more of a warning story. And I think that one of the
But do you want to have your insurance company have the legal ability to just blow you off, even though you've been making payments for years and years? Because all of a sudden, God forbid, you got cancer.
You know, I do think it makes sense to look at how what regulations are out there and how to protect people who have been paying in so that an insurance company has to act like an insurance company.
So you're in favor of government regulation of insurance companies.
Some government regulations are prudent and make sense. In particular, when it comes to one of the problems is that we don't have a deregulated healthcare system, and there's a lot of problems. It makes it hard on consumers and hard on insurers, for that matter, to provide products that make sense when it comes to healthcare. You know, one of the things that's not talked about, but I think is really kind of central to when we're talking about the private insurance or individual insurance marketplace, is just how completely unfair it is. The government policy that right now absolutely favors those who have employer-provided health care. That's really the one of the worst things going in the insurance market, because if you're out there and you're buying individual insurance, you have to do it with after-tax dollars. You've already paid taxes on this money, and then you have to go out and buy your health insurance simply because you're not employed by somebody who offers you insurance. But for all those folks who are sitting there and working for big corporations that provide very cushy, very generous health insurance packages, they're all doing that with pre-tax dollars. So that's a really unlevel playing field. So I think we should all
agree.
Yeah, that's one of the first places to start.
I mean, that's something that should have been done a couple of decades ago, and it's something that, frankly, Democrats have been advocating for and Republicans have been opposing.
Really? Because I know that the president came out for that earlier and talked about the need to try to level this playing field so that private insurance was deductible. And I thought that it didn't get much traction on Capitol Hill. But, hey, this could be a bipartisan moment, and
well,
and we could all jump
on board. Was this during the Republican, when the Republicans controlled the House and the Senate? Because I remember writing about this like 6 years ago, and the take then was that folks like Greenspan and the traditional kind of corporate conservatives were opposed to this because they felt that if people could get health insurance anywhere they went more easily, if they didn't have to get it from their employer, if there was a penalty if they lost their employer, then they would be more likely to leave their employers, and it would stir up the job market.
I sure don't think so. As far as, you know, all the groups I talk to and work with, from the Cato Institute and Heritage Foundation, this is one of the top to-do lists, is to change the tax treatment so that individual insurance, like employer-provided health insurance, is deductible. So I think that, you know, maybe there is more bipartisanship. I think that sometimes
perhaps. On the other hand, you know, what you're suggesting, that if you or I as individuals were to buy health insurance that is tax deductible, just like a corporation, that then becomes the camel's nose under the tent towards saying, we're not going to do any employer-provided health insurance anymore. You're all on your own now. And by the way, isn't it cool that you get a tax break?
Well, but I think that, I don't know.
Is that
so bad? If, you know, one of the real problems that's facing our employment, our healthcare system and our, frankly, our job market is that there's a lot of people who feel tied to their jobs because of their health insurance.
Okay, so we're both agreeing that employer-provided health insurance is imperfect.
Absolutely.
Okay, so then the question becomes, why have corporations, private companies, that are taking anywhere from 15% to 30% of our healthcare dollars, of our insurance dollars, and using them to pay huge salaries, to pay bloated bureaucracies, to pay for gold-plated faucets on the corporate jet's bathroom, to pay for advertising and marketing campaigns, to pay for dividends to stockholders, and to pay hundreds of millions of dollars in lobbying, instead of, for example, Medicare, which has a 3% overhead. Why should we turn our healthcare dollars over to these companies rather than to Medicare? Why not go to a single-payer healthcare system and call it Medicare?
Well, I think that I bet a lot of people in the audience know instinctively what a problem it would be for the government to take over all of our healthcare system. One of the problems.
Well, they're running two of the largest healthcare systems in the country, Medicare and the Veterans Administration.
Yeah, and I think if you ask a lot of people in the Medicaid and Medicare system for that matter, a lot of them expressed a great deal of frustration, lack of doctor choice, just lack of quality of care. And one of the
problems. Nothing compared to not being insured.
Well, sure, but compared to, you know, when we think about things that work well and things that don't work well, one of the main, factors is often an incentive, is competition. And the simple fact is that too often when you have a monopoly or a one party or one provider system, they don't have an incentive to take care of their customers.
Well, I'm not suggesting we make private insurance illegal. I mean, there's always going to be people who have high incomes who are going to want, better, faster, cooler health care than anybody else gets. And there's always going to be a market of people to provide it to them. But, isn't it obscene, frankly, that we have millions and millions of that 50%, more than 50% of all bankruptcies in this country are caused by people getting sick?
Well, sure, and I think that's why we need to make it easier for people to buy insurance. Right now, some of the things that make
out of their own pockets.
Out of their own pockets, or there's.
But that's not spreading the risk around. I mean, a single family can't handle the whole point of insurance is to spread the risk. You get as many people involved as possible.
Well, sure, but if we had if our individual insurance, it shouldn't be our health insurance should not be as expensive as it is right now. There's a lot of regulations so that in some states you have to the individual health insurance you buy or the health insurance you buy has to include mental health care. And while you may decide that that's something you want, I may decide that's something I want. We all know you're going to pay more. Your premiums are going to go up if it provides for things like mental health care. That's one of the reasons why I think that we should deregulate, encourage there to be a more choice when it comes to insurance packages so that people can have things like high deductible.
So people can choose to be underinsured.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Basically.
And I think that
you don't think that there's going to be a harm to society in that when those underinsured people get hit with a $500,000 health care bill that they can't pay?
Yeah, there's also a great cost to moving towards a single payer system. If you look at what goes on in Canada, one of the things we should both kind of admit when we're talking about the healthcare system is there's not going to be a perfect system. There's going to be some winners and some losers from any system you create, whether that's government shortages or a few people who can't get healthcare because it's too expensive.
I'll agree with you on that.
Great.
Absolutely. Carrie Lucas, Vice President of Policy and Economics at the Independent Women's Forum, IWF.org is their website. Carrie, thanks for dropping by.
Thank you.
16 minutes past the hour.
This is Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news.
Got
got my tonsils out in Taiwan, my gallbladder out in Greece. Took a side trip up to Sweden to fill some caverns in my teeth. Saw a doctor down in Denmark and a specialist in Spain to see what could be causing me this dull but steady pain. Took a trip up to Toronto just to buy some little pills. Thought I'd died and gone to heaven when they handed me the bill. Went to Norway when I noticed that my eardrum had a hole. Got back home just in time to watch the Super Bowl. It's been a brutal year, but man, I'm glad I was overseas, where you can see the doctor when you really got a need. Where people, they live longer, babies also like they should. I guess they call it healthcare, and I guess they got it good.
I guess this thing called healthcare, how strange it is. Well, you know, the fundamental difference between John McCain and Barack Obama on these issues, in my opinion, boils down to this deep philosophical difference between the role of government in these things. And, well, for example, you know, Ronald Reagan, famous for saying,
I've always felt the nine most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
Yeah. And you know, 1981, Reagan being sworn into office, ushered in an era which has, by and large, extended right up to this day. You'll recall it was Bill Clinton who said the era of big government is over. It was Bill Clinton who aggressively actually shrunk the size of government, the number of employees, although the number of contractors went up. I mean, it's flip a coin, but nonetheless, it was Bill Clinton who gave us balanced budgets. But Reagan, I would say Reagan, Bush, Clinton, and Bush have all had basically the philosophy that the role of government should be highly limited, highly restricted, and that most things are solved best by the free market. And if you're talking about consumer goods, I absolutely agree. I don't want the government making my TV set. I don't want them making my computer. I don't want them making my shoes. I don't want them making my blue jeans. I don't want them making my car. When I lived in Germany, the little East German cars, the Trebis, they were a disaster. Government-manufactured cars, little three-cylinder things that left a huge cloud of smoke behind them wherever they went and weren't upgraded for decades. And, you know, you could get them in one color. And it's just, I think they had multiple colors for them. But in any case, I don't want the government engaged in those things. But the one reason why we have government, and this is why it blows my mind that we don't even have civics classes of any consequence in our high schools anymore, because you got kids graduating from school who obviously don't even know why we created the United States of America in the first place. They think it was about getting rid of taxes. In fact, the whole tax thing had to do with, you know, the British East India Company getting a tax break on their tea. The no taxation without representation, as it tied into the Boston Tea Party, was the colonist objecting to a tax break for a big corporation, while taxes were still being hit at fairly high levels on their small entrepreneurial import shops. So, you know, it was an objection to Walmart, as it were. But nonetheless, the split, I would say, breaks down to, Obama is taking the position, or a position very close to the position, that health care in the United States is a right, and that it falls broadly under the rights defined in the Constitution, or the Declaration of Independence anyway, the preamble of the Constitution as well. In the preamble of the Constitution, the reference is to the general welfare. In the Declaration of Independence, the word is happiness, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But here's the opening sentence of the Constitution, what it says, why we created this country. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice. Tell people who could be disappeared by the president about that one. Ensure domestic tranquility. Provide for the common defense. Promote the general welfare. And secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Doesn't say anything about Iraq in there. Do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. So, broadly speaking, the people have the right, under the welfare clause or the welfare reference in the preamble of the Constitution, have a right to health care, that health care should be a right. John McCain is taking the contrary position, the classic Republican conservative position, that no, health care is a privilege, that whether you live or die is a privilege. There is no right to life in the United States, according to John McCain and the Republican Party, and some Democrats for that matter. There is no right to life. If you are sick, for actual living, breathing humans, if you are sick and you may die and you don't have the money to solve that problem, see you later, Charlie. That's the bottom line from the Republican point of view. You know, and if you chose to get a high-risk insurance, health insurance policy, or if you chose to be underinsured, hey, it was your choice. That's the Republican point of view. The Democratic point of view is and has been ever since Harry Truman proposed national health care in 1947 and couldn't get it through a Republican legislature. The Republicans controlled the House and the Senate that year. The Democratic position has always been that health care is a right. It's been more or less explicit by various people at various times, but that's the bottom line. And I think we really need to frame the debate in those terms. Is health care a right or a privilege? And if it's a right, then our government has the obligation to protect our rights or to provide for our rights, protect our life, our right of life, and our right and through the general welfare clause. It's absolute.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Good plan. 35 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. If you want to drop into our live chat room, go to TomHartman.com and click chat up at the top. Or you can find a link off AirAmerica.com/Tom Hartman page. You can find all the information there. And you'll also find links to the Tom Hartman page and on Air America to our Tom Vision. We're webcasting the shows now. Frank in Fort Lauderdale, listening on WINS. Hey, Frank, what's on your mind today?
Good afternoon, Tom. I was just wondering, I listen to you regularly, and I heard about the fact that as far as a government auto industry, you wouldn't be in favor of it with your experiences in the past. And I would believe that if you don't want the government making the decisions for you as far as what type of car you drive, why do you think they would do a good job at decisions on health care? I don't quite understand that.
Because with regard to a car, I may have, 15 different preferences, 15 different needs. You know, some people want big cars, some people want small cars. There's a whole, it's a consumer product. It doesn't have to do with my ability to survive, my life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I do want the government regulating the auto industry. I want them to tell me, I want to know that my car is not going to blow up, turn into a fireball if it gets rear-ended. I mean, this is what Ralph Nader brought us. I want the government to tell the car companies that their cars have to get a certain minimum gas mileage. There is a role for government in the marketplace. I want to know that the toys that I buy for my children are not bought for my kids back in the days when they used toys, were not contaminated with lead, things like that. I mean, there is a reasonable role for government in the private industry. But when we're talking about the commons, Frank, when we're talking about the things that we all collectively own, and particularly the risks that we all collectively share, those commons, whether it's our water, whether it's our air, I would argue our power, more than half the power in the United States is provided by publicly owned utilities. I think it should be all. They are, in almost all cases, more efficient and deliver electricity at a lower cost because you don't have stockholders basically skimming the profits off the top. And I would submit to you that health care is part of the commons. that there are such large risks. You get sick, you get injured, you break your neck, and you're paralyzed for the rest of your life. We're talking about hundreds of thousands to tens of millions of dollars in terms of the cost of care over a lifetime. Such huge risks that it's absolutely unreasonable to assume that one person can bear those risks, or to ask one family or even one extended family or even one neighborhood or community to bear those risks. We have to do that collectively on the largest scale possible, which minimizes the risks for all of us individually.
Well, you have to understand that, Tom, our government has two powers. If me and you were farmers and the government wanted us to grow wheat, what they would do is they would subsidize us. If they did
not necessarily
grow corn, the government has two powers: the power to tax and the power to subsidize. We should be subsidizing what we want. We should be taxing what we don't want. And unfortunately, in a socialist type mentality, what you end up doing is you end up taxing people who are innovative and hardworking. And you tend to subsidize people who are happy doing and performing at bare minimums. And you cannot.
Well, if that's the case, Frank, why is it that when you go into a state-of-the-art hospital, the really coolest equipment is all made outside the United States in countries that have what you would call socialist healthcare systems?
Well, as a matter of fact, Tom, I am in the healthcare community, and I can tell you, I work in the cardiac field. I can tell you, in South Florida, we get Canadians come down here who are on 6-month waiting lists for cardiac catheterizations. They come down here and they walk into a hospital and have the procedure. I also go to school with guys who do the exact same job I do all over the United States, North and South America. I was at dinner with a gentleman who does the exact same job at me from Canada. Okay? I'm an engineer. His tax rate is at 51%.
And
Tom, I don't want to pay 51 cents on a dollar to have a health care.
Consider something for a second, Frank. Consider something for a moment, Frank. Do you mind telling me how much money you make a year?
You disagree with what I'm saying?
I'm just going to extend this for a moment. If you don't want to tell me how much you make in a year, just, you know, let's just pick a number. Let's just say Frank makes $70,000 a year, okay? Just for the hell of it, just for the purpose of discussion, because I want to talk about taxes with you for a second around this, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Let's just imagine that you make $70,000 a year. You're paying 50% tax. That means that you're walking home with $45,000 a year, right?
No, what? Sir. That means you're making you're coming home with $35,000.
Thirty-five.
Thirty-five
out of 70.
Mortgage bill. If you've got a $200,000 house on a 30-year fixed mortgage.
Now, just stay with me for a second here, Frank. Just stay with me for a second.
Let me rebut what you say. Go ahead.
Sure. Yeah. Let's say you're making 70 and you're taking home 35. What that and because you're paying a 50% tax. What that means is that your employer knows that you're willing to work for $35,000 at the end of the day, right?
If you stayed at that job or stayed in that country, I guess so.
Yeah. And employers understand that there's a market for employees, and the market for employees really has nothing to do with taxes. It has to do with how much money people have at the end of the day, you know, after taxes. So your employer knows that you're willing to work for $35,000 a year. Now, let's say that you're living in Canada and paying 50% income tax, and all of a sudden George Bush takes over Canada and cuts taxes down to 20%. And so you're still making $70,000 a year, but now instead of taking home $35,000 a year, you're taking home, and apparently you can do math in your head faster than me, you're taking home something like $50,000 a year, right?
That's correct.
What's your employer going to do? They know that you'll do that job for $35,000 a year. Do you think that they're going to continue paying you $70,000?
Well, what you're doing there is you're building a straw man and you're knocking them.
No, I'm not, because look at the last 7 years. George Bush cuts taxes, and what happens? Pay goes down. Look at the 8 years that preceded that. Bill Clinton increased taxes, and what happened? Pay went up. The bottom line is the marketplace will always compensate for taxes. That's why in Sweden with 50%, 55% tax rates, people are making enough money to live. And that's why in the United States with 25% tax rates or 30%, 32% maximum, people are making enough to live. The bottom line is it doesn't matter. You say, oh, my God, they're paying 51% tax rate, but they don't have to pay for health care.
Okay, well, out of that $35,000, Tom, if you've got a $200,000 30-year mortgage, you're paying $2,000 a month on a mortgage payment with taxes and insurances. That's $24,000 a year. So on that $70,000 income, you got $35,000 left after taxes. After you pay your $200,000 mortgage payment for the year, you can subtract $24,000 from $35,000. So you have
you're living on 11 grand. No, I understand, Frank. I totally understand. My point is that whether the taxes go up or down over the short term, over 1 year, yeah, you're going to notice a difference. But if you average that over a five-year period, and I defy you to find any time in the history of the United States, and I've looked at 200 years of these numbers, any time in the history of the United States when this has not been the case, over a five-year period, it will eventually average out. What you will find is that the labor market is always defined by after-tax revenue, after-tax income.
At the Carter administration, Tom. That's all you got. And going, I've got to go. One last question, Tom.
Yeah.
Does anybody know whether or not Randy Rhodes...
Marzina in Toronto, Canada. Hey, Marzina.
Hi. Hi.
My apologies for Frank's...
that's okay. Am I on the air right now?
You are. Welcome to our program.
Okay. You're welcome. Listen, I called because I was listening to the interview you were having with the lady about healthcare, just previous lady that you were interviewing. And she said something, and I just wrote this down. She says, if you look at what's going on in Canada, and that got to me. Because I've heard that opinions many times on your radio, people would call, and against the health insurance.
And you're listening to us from Toronto, Canada.
Yeah, I'm calling from Toronto, Canada. Mm-hmm. I've lived in Canada for 25 years. So she says something like that, and I go, okay, where those statistics are coming from? What those people know that I don't know that I...
Marzina, we just have a minute before we've got to take a break. Are you saying that you like or even love the health care that you get in Canada?
Of course.
Why?
Of course. It's the main reason is that, you know what, I've been hospitalized many times. Well, not many, some. I have a child who had some problems. I go to doctor every year for checkups. My son goes for checkups. I never, ever in my life had a thought cross my mind how I'm going to pay for it.
Yeah.
You know, that's the main thing. Ever, never. There is a problem, you call your doctor.
Now, what about having to wait 6 months to get a cardiac catheterization or
I've
something
I've never
like
heard
that.
Of such a thing.
Yeah.
I had some problems, and I had surgeries right away, checkups right away. And I live in a big city. I live in Toronto, where a couple of million people still live.
Interesting. So there's a lot of competition for it. Marzina, thank you very much for the call.
Yeah.
And thanks for listening to us there in Toronto. I appreciate it. 866-303-2270, TomHartmann.com. If you want to drop into our live chat room, the status of healthcare and the news of the day coming up next.
Tom Hartmann.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Still last 10 years like they should.
All right.
The best of a free life behind us now. The good times really over for good. Stop rolling downhill like a snowball headed for hell. Sing it with me. Stand up for the flag and let's all ring the liberty bell.
You tell them, Willie.
Let's make a Ford and a Chevy that would still last 10 years like they should.
I think they're starting to.
Cause the best of the free life is still yet to come. The good times ain't over for good.
There you go. 51 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Show. David in Portland, Oregon. Hey, David, what's on your mind?
I think I want to agree with your previous caller about what was said in passing at the end of that conversation you had with that woman from the Independent Women's Group.
Yeah.
I know lots of Canadians, and I've never heard any complaints whatsoever. In fact, they talk about how good their health care is, and they don't understand why we don't get on board.
Yeah, I my experience has been the same, David. I do know a lot of Canadians, and I have yet to hear the complaints. I don't get it. John in Miami. In fact, our producer is a Canadian, Sean Taylor. John in Miami. Hey, John.
Hi, how you doing?
Just great. What's up?
Here you go. Listen, I just wanted to suggest something when it comes to talking to people about the health care issue, specifically talking to consumers and trying to help them to see the light. A lot of them just have an instinctive, just visceral reaction to the idea of saying that health care is a right. It goes against their worldview.
Yeah.
Like if you go by the lack off theories, they're...
Yeah. John, your phone is breaking up really badly. If you can make your point.
Well, here's the thing. If you call it a right, it gets their backup. But if you say that it is something that the government can rightfully provides or justly provides to help us to secure our rights to life and property and liberty and so forth, such as just as it provides police service or fire service and things like that, I've had it. That worked successfully. And
yeah, that, it makes a lot of sense, John. And in fact, we did a show here on the privatization of fire departments. there was a time in the United States when we had private fire departments, and it didn't work out all that well. And that's a great example of sharing the risk. It's a very good example, in fact. Mickey, a pharmacist in San Francisco, listening on Green 960. Hey, Mickey.
Hi, Tim.
Tom.
Tom.
Okay.
Well, speaking of Tim, before I say anything, I just got to say, with Tim Russert's passing, I really appreciate your thoughtful conversation with America.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you. We're all going to miss him. There are a lot of things about Tim Russert, a lot of his, a lot of things I disagreed with and a lot of things I agreed with. But by and large, at the bottom line, he was, to all accounts, a very decent guy. So.
One of the things I wanted to say is, as a pharmacist dealing with a specialized disease state like HIV, I can't tell you how many times I can tell you how many times I've heard somebody pleased with their insurance.
Mm-hmm.
None.
Yeah.
Anybody who's pleased with their insurance is healthy and they don't know any better.
I can tell you, I have pretty decent health care and have, thank God for most of my life, I've had an income that has allowed me to have the top end policy that is available. And now, even with that, right now, if I go to see the doctor, or I have lab tests or whatever, and you do this on a regular basis. See, I don't have any particular health problem that I'm complaining about other than having had pneumonia when I came back from Africa a while ago. Well, that's case in point. I came back from Africa with pneumonia. And first of all, I tried to get a doctor's appointment. They said, come back in a week. And I'm like, I got a fever of 103. I'm barfing so bad I can hardly move. I'm coughing so bad I think I've broken two ribs. I think I have pneumonia. Go to an ER then. And it's like, no, I just need antibiotics.
why is your pharmacist, why are they all busy? Because they're spending half of their time filling out forms for
insurance companies. That's right.
We're not providing health care anymore. We're filling out forms. And the difficulty is that with all of the different insurance companies, there's 100 different forms, 1,000 different rules.
Right.
You deal with a company like Blue Cross,
and you call one number, you're talking to somebody else. The left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing.
Right, and from the consumer's point of view, it's even worse. I mean, after I finally, actually I went to ZoomCare, which is a local dock-in-the-box, you know, we'll see you within 15 minutes thing, ZoomCare.com on the web. It's just for Portland, but it's really a cool idea. And the doctor saw me in 15 minutes. He gave me a prescription for the antibiotics, and within 6 hours, my fever was down, and I was, you know, I was getting better. But when the bill was submitted to the insurance company, the insurance company sent us about 2 weeks later, sent us a copy of the bill saying, if you don't, and a form to fill out, and said, if you don't fill out this form and send it back to us within 15 days, we will not pay the bill. And I'm sure that what they found is that if they send those things out to 100% of their customers, 10, 20% of their customers are on vacation, they don't get around to it, they think it's junk mail and throw it away.
Or what they do is they pile you, they send you, if you've got a serious medical condition, they send you, you'll get mail practically every other day. So they overwhelm you, like the Reagan administration used to do to investigations. They just throw everything at you to the point where you're overwhelmed and you can't see it.
Right.
Now, here's my argument for healthcare reform that maybe the Republicans might be able to get on board with. And that is that it's not really been talked about, which is the larger cost of the healthcare system. They're always talking about, oh, well, you know, the baby doctors, they can't treat the women they love. What was that quote from
yeah,
Bush?
George Bush, yeah.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. If healthcare was part of our culture and our society, everything would be paid for. There wouldn't be any need for large liability policies anymore.
Right.
The cost of your automobile insurance, your home insurance, all of those issues would be drastically reduced as well.
Yeah, good point, Mickey. And your health care costs would be cut dramatically, because we know that, you know, 15 to 30% of all health care dollars are just going into the pockets of CEOs and stockholders.
Tom Hartman.
Helping you win the water cooler wars.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
The True People's Radio.
Tom Hartman.
Now, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to the second hour of our program. A couple of things here. By the way, our quote for the day, cats, this is from Jeff Valdez, cats are smarter than dogs. You can't get 8 cats to pull a sled through the snow. Well said. By the way, we have new videos up over at TomHartman.com. One is the Beware of Higgins video. Another is Ralph Reed and I. This is where I asked him if he felt that as a Christian and as a conservative, he should be seeking repentance for all the death and bloodshed in Iraq. It's very interesting. And also I'd like to just toss out to say to all of the gay couples who are getting married in California right now, it's in the news, it's all over, and it's happening, that as a guy who has been married to the same person for 35 years, welcome to the institution of marriage. I think it's a fine thing, and I think it's absolutely wonderful that we can welcome into the family of Americans, of married Americans, which is not to say there's anything wrong with being single Americans, but nonetheless, welcome to the family of married Americans to gay couples in California. We've been talking, in the last hour, we've been talking about oil. And Congressman Peter DeFazio coming on pointing out that, in fact, I gave that study to you, Louise, I need it back, pointing out that there's over 10,000, thank you, Sean, over 10,000 drilling permits that the oil companies are sitting on, that they're not using on these lands. There's the 28,700 permits that were issued between 1999 and 2007. Only 18,000 wells, 954 wells were actually drilled. These are all permits. The reason that it got to the permit level is that they know that there's oil under the ground. These are all that means that the oil companies, this from the Committee on Natural Resources, the majority staff report, The Truth About America's Energy, Big Oil Stockpile Supplies and Pockets Profits, that means that oil companies have stockpiled nearly 10,000 extra permits to drill that they are not using to increase domestic production. Of the 47.5 million acres of federal lands that are currently being leased by oil and gas companies, only about 13 million acres are actually in production. And offshore, They have 44 million acres leased. They're only producing out of 10 million, and they have the legal right to drill right now into the additional 33 million. What this is all about, what this whole Gingrich Republican thing is all about, is giving the oil companies more leases and more drilling permits when they're not using the ones that they have right now. It's using a crisis to increase their profits and their bottom line, in my opinion. Terry Jeffrey is with us. He's the editor-in-chief of CNSnews.com. And, Terry, you've heard my pitch. Your take on it?
Well, let me. I think I can offer an explanation for some of that. I can't specifically say what each one of those leases are, but I would refer people to a report that the Bureau of Land Management put out just last month. I'm looking at it right now on my computer. I downloaded the PDF a couple weeks ago. We've done a lot of reporting on it. It's called Inventory of Onshore Federal Oil and Natural Gas Resources and Restrictions to Their Development. It was produced by the Department of Interior as a result of the Energy Policy Act of 2005. But, Tom, what it says in short is that even the land that is leasable for oil in the United States and some of the places where these leases are, oil companies cannot effectively drill because of a multitude, mostly of environmental regulations.
Right, but that's leasable. What about the 33 million acres that they already have leased?
No,
that they're sitting on? And what about the 10,000 drilling permits that they have that they're not using?
Right, well, let me offer, I can't specifically address these particular drilling leases, but what this report says is that even on the land that is leasable and presumably where there are leases, environmental regulations, sometimes that are very specific to a particular place.
These 33 million leased acres are leased for exploration. It's already been licensed.
I understand
it's
that.
Wait a minute.
But here's an explanation for what people can look.
There's 33 million acres offshore, by the way. It's 44 million acres onshore.
Okay, let me answer your question. This report put out by the BLM last month points out that even though this land is leasable, much of the leasable land, or the land that has been leased, cannot be drilled because, in practical terms, what needs to be done to actually drill the oil cannot be done because it runs afoul of one or another federal regulation or law. Most of those laws and regulations involving the environment.
Yeah,
people want
like
to know the details. They can read the report. It goes every single region in the United States where there's oil. This report goes detail by detail by detail and shows the law and regulation in that.
Well, of course, we want to protect our environment. But you're talking about bananas while I'm talking about apples, Terry. I'm talking about leases that have been granted,
right,
permits that have been given for drilling. The federal government has said go for it. For example, what used to be called the Naval Petroleum Reserve up in Alaska.
Right.
It's now referred to as the Federal Reserve. It's 13.5 billion with a B, barrels of oil, known to exist there.
Right.
It's already been leased to the oil companies. They were given permits to drill. They drilled. They already had, and they capped the wells. They have been sitting on this stuff since the first Bush administration, not because anybody told them to, but because they have chosen not to pump that oil. The infrastructure is there. They could get it to shore, or they could get it to the coast and put it into tankers. They could be bringing it down to the north, to the rest of North America. They're choosing not to do so. They're not explaining why they're choosing not to do so, but we're talking about 13 billion barrels of oil that's already got a straw sticking out of it.
Right. Well, I can't address why that particular company is not drilling in that particular area. I would guess that is not profitable for them. I will tell you that, wait a minute, the same BLM report, anybody can look it up on the Internet and read it themselves. It says, according to the official estimate of the Department of Interior, they say there's 139 billion barrels of what they call undiscovered, technically recoverable oil in the United States. This is oil that, with our current technology, we could go get, that through reasonable science, they believe is there. Most of it, 85.9 billion barrels, is offshore. Tom, that is more oil than Iran has. It's more oil than Iraq has.
I understand that. But you're talking about things like oil shale and things like that.
No, you're talking about technically recoverable. No,
I'm talking about actual oil that we know is in the ground right now.
No, that's not what I'm talking about. This is not shale oil. This is regular oil. This is the kind of oil they're pumping out of existing oil wells in the United States that can be recovered, according to the Department of Interior, with current technology.
Okay, so what you're saying is that what you're identifying, Terry, is all that oil that the oil companies want to add to their portfolio right now, using this crisis as the rationale, and then they won't drill it anyway because they're not drilling the stuff they have.
Let's you and me, maybe you have some wealthy listeners out there, why don't they invest in you and me? You and me will start an oil company. We'll convince these bozos in the government to let us go out there and drill it, and you and me will make money. If Exxon and Mobil, if the big oil companies don't want to do it, I'll do it.
There's a bunch of small oil companies that are out there as well, Apache and others, and I mean, it's not just the big ones, but they're all playing basically the same game. I mean, the people in this industry know what's going on. They're not dummies.
Well, look, people can read the government spend report. This was something that was done at the behest of Congress. It's gotten very little attention, and it is just a fact that most of this oil cannot be drilled because of, let me give you a specific example of what the sort of thing they say. Okay, there's some places where there's oil under federal land. Leasing is allowed, but you can only work on the surface of the land for 3 months because of the Endangered Species Act. Or you can't even disturb the surface of the land because of the environmental regulations.
Yeah.
But you can buy a lease.
Again, you're talking about the banana. I'm talking about the apple. But, you know, and I think that it's a good thing, by the way, that that's the case. We want to protect this planet upon which we live and the web of life that we're a part of. But let's, at least in my opinion, I know you're disagreeing with that, but let's, in the couple minutes we have left, and maybe sure. We can carry this over the break, I wanted to get into this article that you wrote because I thought that this was great. It's titled "The Threat to the Car" by Terrence Jeffrey. We're talking with Terrence Jeffrey, the editor-in-chief at CNSNews.com. And you say, some liberals would like to use government to force Americans out of their cars. They believe in socialized transportation, not free market transportation. In a free market transportation system, a person purchases his own vehicle with his own money, buys his own gas with his own money, and can drive his vehicle anywhere there is a road. I think you missed a word in there, Terry. Can drive his vehicle anywhere there is a socialist road.
Mm-hmm.
Our highway system is socialist.
Well, listen, I think
it's the only thing that makes it possible for you to have this, what you call a free market car system.
Well, you know what? And I first of all, I do concede that point in my column that these roads are generally paid for by the government. And I concede that, and I would say, look, you know, as long as there's a net balance between the taxes that are taken from drivers to pay for roads and bridges and the amount of money that's paid to build roads and bridges, that's fine with me.
So you are in favor of socialism?
Well, to that extent, yes. I think that is a social compact we've made in the United States. And my point
then why are you opposed to public transportation?
Well, I'll tell you why. Because another thing I point out in my column is that when you own your own car and you can put your own gas in it, we have this massive system of roads that we, with our gas taxes and other taxes, have built. We have the freedom to go where
our,
we want.
Our socialist road system has given us that freedom. Terry, let's continue this conversation after the break. We're talking with Terry. If that's okay with you.
Sure.
Okay, great. We're talking to Terry Jeffrey. He's the editor-in-chief at CNSNews.com. The threat to the car. You can read Terry's piece over at CNSNews.com. Are we going to continue to be a socialist nation on our roads? I think it's a great question. 16 minutes past the hour. Stick around.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Truth in Broadcasting.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Tell you, there's going to be days like these. Oh man, all the strange stories out there. Oh, it's the liberals who are trying to take your gas away. No, sorry, 30 years of Reaganomics and George Bush is destroying the infrastructure of this country. Speaking of the infrastructure of this country, Terry Jeffrey with us, the editor in chief of CNSNews.com. Terry, you've acknowledged in your article and in our conversation that if we didn't have a socialized highway system, people wouldn't have the so-called free market freedom to drive their car. We also have a socialized economic system in as much as the government is stabilizing our and providing us with a stable currency system, to the money that you'd use to buy the car, that the government is involved in whether the cars are going to produce pollution that kills people and whether they're designed to be safe. I mean, at what point do you, you know, and people can drive the car because they can read, because they got a socialist education in a free, public school system?
I didn't get a socialist education.
I will resist the urge to make a smart aleck remark here. No, actually, you're a very smart guy, Terry, and I acknowledge that. And in fact, two of my three kids didn't altogether. You know, we had one that we homeschooled and one that went to a private school. So I've seen all three of them. But in any case, you're suggesting that we should go to a totally non-socialist free market transportation system, and you're trashing it seems to me that the main point for your trashing public transport, you know, buses and subways and trains and things, is that they limit freedom of choice. And I'm wondering, have you ever traveled around in Europe?
Yeah, I have, as a matter of fact. But look, I take your point, Tom. I'm not an anarchist and I'm not a libertarian. And I understand that there's a certain amount of collective activity we engage in here, so we have our modern transportation system with paved highways and cars that we can drive on. Once upon a time, people used to wander around the countryside in horses. We don't do that anymore. But I think there's a couple of places where it balances. First is just one in what the Constitution says and limits on government. That's not so crucial here. I think what's more crucial here is, for me as a conservative and someone who believes individual liberty is, in fact, one of the things at the core of what America's all about, it's always a question of dependence and independence. And I think we want to the degree it's practically possible, maximize individual independence without stomping on other people's rights, without doing things that are immoral, and minimize government dependence. And I do see a trend in American society to force people to be dependent on the government for their movement. Once upon a time, not so long ago, I think the left in this country resisted that. If you look at cultural icons of the left in the 50s and 60s, there were people like Jack Kerouac, who wrote On the Road, who was driving around with Dean Moriarty, Neil Cassidy, all around the country in cars.
Yeah.
In the 1960s, you had rock and roll celebrating the car, and we're talking about every kind of rock and roll. You had Ken Kesey in his bus, and it was a privately owned bus that went where he wanted to go. It seems to me that that independence and that mobility and that freedom of movement is built into the American soul. And there is an element in our culture and our politics that wants to take it out.
Well, Terry, I will acknowledge, I'll agree with you, and to a certain extent, and acknowledge that there is that Davy Crockett, you know, I've got mine, I'm going to toss on my coonskin cap and take my gun and go out and carve a new life out of the American wilderness. But the reality is that most of the framers of the Constitution, the founders of this country, were far more communalists than they were libertarians. I mean, the whole idea of creating this country was for the public good. It wasn't for the individual. I mean, you know, certainly they were celebrators of individual rights and individual liberties, but you can't have individual rights and liberties if the public is unstable. I mean, that was the big point that they made. It's like Franklin Roosevelt in his 36 renomination speech in Philadelphia. He quoted an old English judge once said, "A necessitous man is not a free man. You're not free if you're hungry. You're not free if you're afraid that one illness is going to kill you. You're not free if you can't hop on a public bus and get to work if you can't afford a car."
Well, there's a little too much materialism in your analysis for me. But I'm not a libertarian, as I said, and I think true conservatives believe in ordered liberty. And that, you know, we believe in a level of government that is prudent for the protection of liberty. And I don't think people should be able to go.
But you're essentially calling for doing away with public transportation here.
No, I'm not calling for doing away with public transportation. I think it should pay for itself. And I definitely think that there is a movement, and you can see it around Washington, D.C., where government is willfully and with a strategy attempting to drive people out of their cars and put them in public transportation. Let me give you a scenario, Tom. I was in Washington, D.C. on September 11, 2001, and I found a clever way out of town, and I was able to go pick up some of my kids. My wife was able to get in another car, go to another school, and pick up our kids. I would not want to be in Washington, D.C., dependent on government transportation if there were another terrorist attack. I'd want my own transportation, And I want to be ready to go where I want to go.
So you'd want to be on the roads that are clogged up and choked up and nobody's moving. Well, I mean, if there was a real disaster.
I might have a better strategy for getting out than another guy.
Yeah.
Protecting my family than another guy.
Okay, it's an interesting debate. Terry, I'm sorry, we've got to wrap up. CNSnews.com is his website.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Call Tom at
6-6-302-7└     Isn't this sweet? Michelle Obama, she's on The View. She says, I'd like to be greeted properly. Fist bumps all around. Ah, that's great. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. If you'd like to participate in our blog or live chat, you'll find links both at TomHartman.com and AirAmerica.com. Bruce in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Bruce, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. I was thinking your last gentleman on the phone,
Terry Jeffrey,
should grab his little car and find his own little private island and invite a bunch of his friends. It seems like that kind of individualism doesn't really contribute to any real solution, you know?
Well, I think this is the fundamental cleavage between the liberal and conservative worldview, and Michael Moore said it so brilliantly in his movie Sicko, where there was that moment in the movie toward the end where he turned to the camera and he said, ultimately, and I'm paraphrasing from memory here, but I think this is pretty much what he said. He said, ultimately, we all have to collectively decide, are we a we society or a me society?
Exactly.
And thank you, Bruce. And I would submit that the me society mentality, which is grounded in Reagan conservatism, the me society mentality is what is destroying this country. John in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Hey, John.
Hi, Tom.
Yeah.
Yeah, can you hear me?
I can. Welcome to the show.
Bruce kind of summed it up for me. I was going to comment on Terry Jeffries. I see him on CNN all the time. And, it's that every man for himself mentality. They always bring up the disaster scenario too, you know, that he won't be able to, he won't be able to get out of town or anything, or the Jack Bauer 24 mentality where we have to torture to get the information.
Right. But here's the question, and Terry's not here, and so I don't want to pick on him, and B, I don't want to ask him questions when he's not here, but I think the question largely that we have to ask as a nation, if we're going to come together as a nation, which is one of the stated goals of Barack Obama's candidacy, if we're going to bring America back together and start healing the wounds that really began with Nixon, as we learned yesterday with the author of Nixonland, that of the intentional tearing apart of America, when Roger Ailes was first hired to make Richard Nixon seem more likable and all that kind of stuff, if we're going to heal the wounds of the Roger Ailesness, how do we bring together both sides of that discussion? I mean, here, Terry is saying, yeah, okay, I'll acknowledge that the highway system is socialist. And yet his argument is that without the highway system, he can't have freedom. And that's my point. And so I think that at a certain level, we're saying the same thing. We're just saying it in different ways. And there has to be a way to bridge that gap so that Americans get it, that we have to have both individual liberties and freedoms on the one hand and what Terry calls socialism, that is a community, the web of society, of culture that underpins and supports us and that catches us when we fall, when we become very, very ill or lose our jobs or have disasters befall us.
Right. Well, I'm a social studies teacher here in Ann Arbor, and I really enjoy you talking about the commons.
Yeah.
I try and instill that, when I teach civics classes or history classes or anything like that, I try to teach my students to be citizens instead of employees or consumers or anything like that.
Yeah.
That idea of the commons and the common good as stated in the Constitution. There's really been lost in our society, I believe.
Yeah, absolutely. So. Well, very well said. John, thank you very much. And thanks for teaching really important stuff. That's great that you're out there doing it. God bless you. I mean, that's wonderful. Calvin in Washington, D.C. Hey, Calvin.
Hi, I just wanted to respond to the previous guest. I actually, as you mentioned, I live in Washington, D.C., and he talks about 9/11. We have, in Washington, you've been here. I was here for your Green Convention thing last year.
Oh, great.
And you probably saw our metro.
Over the last 30 years, I've probably spent in aggregate 6 months in Washington, D.C. I've used the metro a lot.
Okay. Well, for the national listeners who don't know what it is, it's a modern subway system. It goes across the entire region, has arms out into the suburbs, and it has roughly 750,000 riders a day.
Right, and it covers two states plus the District of Columbia.
Yeah, and so for this previous guest to sit there and talk about Washington and how he wants his car, we don't have highways in Washington. They were canceled by our forebears so we could have a metro, and our city is a much, much better place because of it. In Washington, you can walk around. You can walk around all hours of the night, most neighborhoods, feel safe, and go hop on the metro and get around. You're not shackled to paying $4 a gallon. You're not shackled to paying $15 a day for parking. You're not shackled to sitting in traffic. Like, his entire concept of freedom is this crazy GM-inspired mid-century fantasy. To me personally, I use the metro, I use the bus every single day because I don't like being shackled to $4 a gallon gasoline.
Right. I guess the question is, are the people in Los Angeles who don't have a functioning public transportation system, because it was bought up by Firestone and GM back in the 20s and destroyed, are the people in L.A. freer and happier with regard to transportation than the people in Washington, D.C. or in Manhattan, where there's also an excellent public transportation system under the roads, under the highways, under the city that was put into place back in the 19th century?
Well, New York's a perfectly good example, too. New York rejected most of their freeways and instead chose years later beefed up the subway system, and the reason why is because if you have freeways slicing through everything, you can't have any sort of walkable town. You're stuck in pollution. No one wants to live next to a freeway, and it just basically salts the earth in terms of livable human communities. So this entire car thing, it was a wonderful idea in 1948 when we were coming out of World War II and needed a way to put people to work, but I think that the horse left the barn, a good 10 years ago,
and now we're just
sending our dollars out of the country to the Middle East.
Yeah, and it's also a wonderful thing in many parts of the country where you really seriously do have to drive a half hour to get to the next community. And, even in Europe, I lived in rural Germany for a year, and there are a lot of communities that you just can't get to by train or places that you really do need a car. And that's why we need to be looking at, hydrogen fuel that is where the hydrogen is created from electrolysis of water using solar power or wind power. Or electric cars, things like that. I mean, there have to be those options, but they ultimately, I think, need to be the less common rather than the more common. Well said, Calvin. Thank you very much for the call. I truly appreciate it. Richard, New York City. Hey, Richard.
Hi. I was in New York. I was in Washington, D.C. on September 11, 2001.
Mm-hmm.
And on the next day, I had to come to New York. My city needed me,
Yeah.
And I hopped on Amtrak. It was running. There were very few people on it. About 25% of the seats were occupied.
Yeah.
And
it's fast. It's efficient. It's clean. And
that's
absolutely.
How they should have gotten the victims of Katrina out of New Orleans. There's a train line that goes directly from New Orleans to Chicago.
Yeah. Yeah. Although I think that part of that was destroyed, but good point, Richard. Thank you very much. And the other hidden cost, and this is something that I think is really worth pointing out, we think we're paying $4 a gallon for gasoline. We're actually paying $10 a gallon for gasoline or more, because where there's an additional $4 a gallon that you're paying in your federal income taxes to pay for the military protection of the transportation and refinery of oil all around the world that ends up in the tank of your gas, that ends up in that gallon of gasoline. So there's an additional $4 that we spend on military infrastructure per gallon of gas, and there's an additional at least $2 to $3 a gallon that we are all paying in added health insurance costs and health costs and loss of productivity to society as a consequence of all the cancers people get and other diseases, asthma and other diseases that are associated with the overuse of cars, the burning of fossil fuels into our atmosphere. So, we need to keep that in mind. Sarah in Los Angeles, listening to K-Talk. Hey, Sarah.
Hi. I live in Los Angeles and I have to drive and I have to commute every day. and it's horrible. I feel shackled to my car. I hate making a car payment. I hate paying for insurance. I hate paying for the gas. I've lived in Seattle previously where you have the great transportation system. You can get on the bus every day. You can walk everywhere. You can have a car if you want to get out of the city, but you don't need it to live in the city. And I felt more free as an individual when I lived in Seattle, when I could jump on the bus or I could walk to, you know, everywhere.
Like, so your experience is that socialist transportation systems produce greater freedom. I mean, here in Portland, we have a very, very advanced public transportation system. And if you're just moving within the city center, within the downtown area, you don't even have to pay. It's free.
Right.
I mean, although they're having some problems with that, you know, with folks just kind of basically living on the train, so they're thinking of charging a perfunctory rate. But nonetheless, the point is, I think that I agree with you that public transportation. And thank you, sir, for the call. Public transportation enhances freedom, doesn't reduce it. So what are we going to do about transportation? What are we going to do about oil? What are we going to do about all this stuff? Jeremy in Reno, Nevada. Hey, Jeremy.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to get your ideas about a suggestion that I have, and that's a windfall profits tax with an exemption for those oil companies that go into these reserves that they're just sitting on. I think that that would do well in Congress because the Republicans would have a really hard time standing up and saying, well, no, we don't want to do this, and it would strike a strong blow at Bush's use of the bully pulpit today.
Yeah. It's an interesting point, Jeremy. Here's the balance that we need to keep in mind. On the one hand, I mean, the first hour of our show today, we talked about how the oil companies are manipulating the price and value of oil, the availability of oil, keeping oil off the market, increasing their stockpiles, thus increasing their assets, their under the ground assets, and saying, you know, hey, look at, we're more profitable, we've got more oil, our stock prices are going up, our executives make more money, on the one hand. And on the other hand, and therefore saying, well, maybe we should have them drill that oil because that would reduce the price of oil. But then on the other hand, do we really want all that oil drilled? Do we really want all that carbon dioxide pumped into the atmosphere? Do we really want to melt down the planet? I don't think so. There's a balancing act here.
Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Don't be scared about the future. We're going to change it all for the better. 9.5 minutes before the hour, 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And congratulations. You know, when I do these caught you doing something right things, we're all kind of trained, I think, perhaps by childhood. You know, a parent with little kids, the first thing, the first word that most little kids say is no, because their parents are, they're trying to protect them. No, don't run out in the street. No, don't put your hand in the stove. No, don't touch that hot iron, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And so we tend to catch people doing things wrong. And instead, we need to be catching people doing things right. You know, you helped put together a great show today, Sean. Thank you. And you too, Louise. And it's, you know, like catching you doing things right. So, I want to catch Senator Jack Reed, the Democrat from Rhode Island, doing something right. Here he is, and our, you know, caught you doing something right for the day. Jolly good fellow. And here he is talking to William Haynes. He's the former general counsel of the Defense Department. Now, this is the lawyer for the Department of Defense, the guy who said, yeah, it's okay to torture people. We can make this happen.
If anything came up, there were all sorts of conditions, and not to mention, Senator,
where in this memorandum is the reference to those conditions?
Not to mention, as you know, the training and the quality of the soldiers.
This is Haynes.
I think these questions malign.
I object strenuously to that. You did a service to the soldiers of this nation. You empowered them to violate basic conditions which every soldier respects, the Uniform Code of Military Justice, the Geneva Convention. Here's what soldiers do. You said the Geneva Convention doesn't apply, and they honestly asked what does apply. And the only thing you sent them was these techniques apply. No conditions, nothing. So don't go around with this attitude of you're protecting the integrity of the military. You degraded the integrity of the United States military. And I finish my question.
Amen. Amen. The Reich put into their place. Steve in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Steve, thanks for calling. What's up?
Hey, Tom Kluger. Who was that?
That was Jack Reed, the Democrat from Rhode Island.
Okay, very good. Hey, I just want to mention, you know, you get all these conservatives and they're, I guess they're business people that always, you know, want these libertarian ideas. But from a business sense, don't progressive ideas make more business sense?
They do. And in fact, when Democrats are elected president, you can go all the way back to the beginning of the 20th century when Democrats or progressives, in the case of Teddy Roosevelt, are elected president, the stock market tends to go up, economic activity goes up, society gets healthier, suicides go down, murder rates go down. When conservatives come into power, and the BBC did a great job of documenting this with conservative administrations over a 100-year period in the UK and Australia, when conservatives come into power, suicides go up, unemployment and homelessness go up, despair goes up, and economic activity goes down.
Right.
We've got a 100-year record in the modern era that we can look at in both the United States, the UK, and Australia.
It seems better to have people employed and you know, supported by various particular government programs, you know, education, safety nets, environment, stuff like that, than it is to have a short-term profit and reduce all those programs.
Yeah, no, absolutely, Steve. Very well said, and thank you for saying it. This is where the commons, this idea, our caller earlier, you know, I talk about the commons a lot. I wrote a book mostly about the commons, We the People. Actually, it's a illustrated book, and it's one of my favorites. This idea that we together can create a nation where we independently can prosper is the foundational idea of the United States, and it has become the European dream, not the American dream. Next week, we're going to be doing our show entirely, the whole week, from Denmark. Denmark, from Copenhagen. Danish Radio has given us their studios, and we're doing it from the studios of Danish National Radio, a socialist radio system, I guess you could call it, and talking about why is Denmark the happiest nation in the world. This is the bookend to the show that we did in March, where I did this show live by satellite phone from Darfur, from the border with Darfur in southern Sudan, in a refugee camp 300 miles from the nearest electricity or road, in the middle of what certainly felt and looked and smelled like hell. And so we're bracketing, you know, the worst place in the world, the happiest place in the world. I think it's going to be fascinating. We're going to get into a lot of detail next week of these questions of what is the commons, how does it work, and what do we have to learn from European nations that are actually finding, even though the sky is gray and maybe more people smoke and drink, yet the country is happier. And the taxes are over 50%, but people are happier. What's the deal? Jim in Hollywood, California, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Jim.
I think that's the reason why people are generally happier there is because it's just more ingrained in the culture to actually hang out with each other and enjoy each other. I lived in Germany as a kid. I had the opportunity to do that, so I have a little bit more of a framework for that. When I lived in Seattle, there's a lot of public transportation. You walk everywhere, so you have a lot more interaction with people. Here in Los Angeles, you don't see anybody unless you happen to run into them in a car.
Right, and you make an appointment to meet them at a restaurant.
Exactly. The train system that they just put in here, the news was saying, oh, nobody rides that. I don't know why they put that in. They were saying that a few years ago. Mm-hmm. Now you can't even find a seat on that thing.
Really?
You cannot find a seat in the morning. It's packed.
Yeah.
Everybody's paying $5 a gallon for gas here.
Yeah, absolutely. Good point. Jim, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Andrew in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Andrew.
Hi, Tom. Thank you so much for the invaluable service you provided the country.
Two
points I wanted to make. First is kind of a rhetorical question. Can't somebody, you know, have a class action suit, a lawsuit against the corporate media for false advertising?
No, To the best of my knowledge, it's not the kind of thing that lends itself to a class action lawsuit. What we can have is a class action, though, and that's called elections. We can let our elected officials know that we want them to enforce the Sherman Antitrust Act. It is time to break up some of these huge corporations, not just in the media, but right across the board, so that there can be competition, so that entrepreneurs can get into the marketplace. And by the way, if you want entrepreneurs coming into the marketplace, give them back bankruptcy protection so that people can take a risk once again in America. Coming up next, Everything You Know Is Wrong, A Young Woman's Guide to Why Feminism Matters.
Tom Hartman.
Helping you win the water cooler wars.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.